We are going to start this morning with a public hearing on House Bill 2429. I'll open that hearing and I'll start with asking I'm pausing because I'm going to ask counsel to talk, but I don't want to do that to her until she's here. So we'll ask Ms. O'Dell to give us just a brief summary of where we're at, and then we'll bring some people forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This case was previously before the committee for a public hearing on March 6th. Since that time, the work group that had been working on the amendments to ORS Chapter 475A, the procedures governing civil forfeiture, have continued to meet to resolve the remaining issues. On Tuesday, the remainder of the issues were resolved, and that resulted in the draft three amendments that you have before you. The Dash 3 amendments provide for a notice, or excuse me, a statement that can be given to a person when property is seized. This informs the individual about the forfeiture process and that their property may be subject to forfeiture. If this notice is given, the forfeiting agency then is allowed to proceed with an administrative forfeiture if they meet the other requirements. If the notice is not given, then they must follow the judicial forfeiture proceeding. It also amends the section dealing with defaults in a judicial forfeiture proceeding when the claimant is a fugitive. In addition, the work group agreed to a sunset date of July 31st of 05. That is presented today only as a conceptual amendment because of the difficulty of incorporating that in the draft for your consideration today.
Thank you. I think we'll bring forward
Dave
Fidanke, Diana Vittelins, and Michael
Michelle.
Burrows. Michelle, I'm sorry. Who wrote this?
I apologize to everyone for slaughtering your names.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Dave. Why don't we start with you?
As the chair is aware, the Dash 3 amendments are the result of a consensus work group that has included both supporters of ballot measure 3 as well as opponents of the ballot measure from the law enforcement community and local governments as well as the Attorney General's office. The issues that, as staff has discussed, the issues that are different in the Dash 3 amendments from the version that the committee looked at its last meeting on this bill are, and I'm going to deal with the two of the three issues. Diana Vittelins will deal with the fugitive issue in a minute. But the first issue has to do with what happens at the time of seizure. Under current law, in general, when property has been seized, it has usually been known at the time of seizure whether or not the agency was likely to pursue forfeiture. And as a convenience, there has been a provision in the law that permitted police officers or whoever was seizing the property to notify the person from whom it was being seized that it was being seized for forfeiture. And that those provisions show up in current law, In current law, on page 16 of the dash 3 amendments, in section 7 of the bill, RRS 475A.055, Now I'm getting confused. Forgive me, Mr. Chair. Let me just describe what happens. At the time of seizure, the officer can give the person not only a receipt for the property, but also provide the information at that time that would be required in a formal notice of intent to pursue forfeiture. And this is really as a matter of convenience for everyone involved, so that there is no need to go back and serve a formal notice of forfeiture under current law if all of the information has been given at the time of the seizure. Under Measure 3, however, it becomes a little bit dicier as to whether and when the decision to seek forfeiture is made. Because under Measure 3, local governments or any seizing agency or forfeiting agency is prohibited from transferring a civil forfeiture proceeding to the federal government without meeting very strict criteria. And at the same time, ballot Measure 3 does not impose any greater restrictions on what may be seized for possible forfeiture at the time of seizure. The greater requirements are only kick in at the time the forfeiture is finalized, at the time of judgment. So the work group wanted to allow agencies to seize property for evidentiary purposes that may be subject to forfeiture later, but not force the seizing agency or the forfeiting agency to make a decision any sooner than is otherwise required under the statute that they're going to pursue forfeiture. So those of us that helped draft Measure 3 were concerned that property might be taken from people, but they would have no notice, they would have no information as to what might happen to that property 10 or 15 days later. And they may not be easily reachable at that time in terms of delivering a notice. So we wanted to be sure that people were given some information, not a formal notice, but information that the property might be subject to forfeiture, and letting them know that they needed to stay in touch with the agency that was going to have control of their property. And this new delivery of information at the time of seizure is contained in Section 5A of the Dash 3 Amendments, which begins on page 10 of the Dash 3 Amendments. And this information contains many of the same types of information that was contained in the old notice of forfeiture, but does not serve as a notice. It is merely providing information to the person from whom the property has been seized that this property may be subject to forfeiture, and that if the person files a claim, if they are later told that it is being seized for forfeiture purposes, if they file a claim, the property cannot be forfeited unless they are convicted. But it can be forfeited without a conviction if they don't file a claim. And again, that follows the provisions of Ballot Measure 3. This provision, as I say, is something that those of us who drafted Measure 3 feel very strongly needs to be included in House Bill 2429. And in return for the consensus agreement to include this provision, we also agreed that there would be a sunset provision on the bill of July 31st of 2005. We were not, those of us who supported Measure 3, we're not crazy to have a sunset provision, but we are happy to have a sunset provision of July 31st, 2005, in return for getting this information provision into the bill. The reason we chose 2005 as the sunset date, and July 31st in particular, was that we wanted to have, to let the courts have enough time to deal with the constitutional challenge to ballot Measure 3 on the basis that it contains more than one amendment that should have been submitted separately. Those in the law enforcement community originally argued for a sunset date of 2003. Those of us who supported ballot Measure 3 felt that was too soon, that if there were some final resolution of the court challenge by the beginning of the next legislative session, we certainly expected that the legislature would take some action on the sunset provision, but we didn't want to require the next session of the legislature to act on this issue if the court challenges were still pending. And I think most of us expect that those court challenges will be on appeal and unresolved at that time. That's all I had on those two issues, Mr. Chair. Ms. Vittelins wanted to present the language relating to fugitives.
Okay. Representative Lowe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me do this question while the issue is still fresh in my mind. Mr. Fedanke, regarding Section 5A, I can understand why you would think it would be very, very advantageous to have notice for the of intent to proceed with forfeiture. But I'm concerned about the fact that that may be de facto additional bail. I mean, it's going, if somebody knows that they're likely to lose their home or something, they're much less likely to, let's say, leave a jurisdiction in order to gather evidence to defend the charges against them. They're much less likely to move around. They're more coerced into staying put. Don't you think that that is just sort of a bail enhancement measure? I don't know why I thought of that,
Chair,
but I just did.
Representative Lowe.
I'm afraid that it would fall to a challenge.
So the work group tried as much as possible to use existing provisions of Chapter 475A and to only make changes in the process that we believed were required by Measure 3. So as much as possible, we wanted to maintain the status quo. Ballot Measure 3 very clearly states that it has no effect on the standards required for the seizure of property, either for evidentiary purposes, protective purposes, or for forfeiture purposes. So this provision was written in this way in order to still allow law enforcement agencies to seize the property that they need to seize, and it would have been seized at that time without ballot Measure 3, but also not to trigger the commencement of forfeiture proceedings by any action necessarily at the time of seizure. And so that's why we chose to do it this way. It's really not a change from existing practice. So in that sense, I don't think it will have any different impact on a defendant's likelihood to remain in the area or not.
I can see what you're trying to do there, Mr. Fedanke. I'm just afraid that it might be used in a way that you hadn't foreseen, and that would be to enhance bail, in effect.
Anything else to add? Thank you, Representative. We
don't think it'll work that way.
We'll change anything.
Okay.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Williams, members of the committee. If you turn to page 23 of the proposed amendments to House Bill 2429.
Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't identify yourself for the record, and I forgot to remind you, so we're both in trouble.
Okay. I apologize. My name is Dinah Vittelins, and I'm from the Oregon Department of Justice. If you turn to page 23, is section 84A. Basically, ballot measure 3, if no claim is filed, a judgment of forfeiture is able to be obtained without a conviction. And so that section was working to implement that part of ballot measure 3. So if property is seized from an individual and they simply make no claim, then no conviction is required. The other thing that we realized was a problem is if you do file a claim and then the person becomes a fugitive, the no conviction could be gotten and the government's forfeiture case would just be out there hanging. And so we drafted a provision that requires that if the claimant, who is also the defendant in a criminal case, becomes a fugitive and there's a civil forfeiture case pending, the government may go into court and file an affidavit with the court that says the defendant is a fugitive, that the government has made good faith efforts to find that person, and so the court can declare that person in default and a judgment of forfeiture will be entered. And that's basically what that section does.
Thank you, Diana. Are there any questions?
Representative Krieger.
Chair Williams. Dinah? What's the time frame that that person has to make claim on the property before it would automatically be forfeited?
Once the notice of seizure and forfeiture is served on the individual, 21 days, which is what existing law is.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
And in the case that the property was seized and possibly forfeited, it's seized from a person who has control of it, but it's not of the owner. Do you go to the owner?
Chair Williams, Representative Krieger, yes, we do. We are required to serve anybody who has an interest in the property.
Any further questions, Representative Ackerman?
Yes. Under 4A, I'm concerned about the default provisions. As I follow you, is it correct that the judgment forfeiting the property then could be entered without the person being convicted of a crime?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, that's correct. And that's exactly what ballot measure 3 says as well.
It does provide for that?
Yes. Ballot measure 3 only applies when a claim is filed.
Okay. Then does the pleading or notice that this person would have inform he or she the consequences of a default, that is, the property is abandoned and the property can be forfeited without conviction?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, basically, if a claim, if a notice of seizure and forfeiture is served on an individual, that person is notified either you file a claim within 21 days or your property will be forfeited. And that's currently how our notice works. In addition, with the proposed informational statement, that will also make a provision that if you're served with a notice of seizure and forfeiture, you must file a claim. Otherwise, the government can take your property without conviction.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Did you wish to say anything?
Mr. Chair. I'm Michelle Burroughs. I have been a member of this work group that the other two folks have testified from, and the work group itself, I would like this committee to know, is made up of representatives of both law enforcement, prosecutor's office, and the defense attorney's bar. I am a board member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I do wish to convey to you that we've worked very hard and we've built a consensus package for you. We have presented to you what the committee as a whole, taken from all of the constituency who will be using this bill, and we believe that it is a pretty good compromise package that deals with all of the issues, the due process issues, the notification issues, as well as implementing ballot measure 3. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Good, thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Let me just say before you leave that we appreciate the hard work that this committee has gone through to work on this implementing language of this ballot measure.
I know it hasn't been easy because people have came to this issue hot after the election, not necessarily in agreement with how things had gone or about the basic philosophy, but I want to commend the work group for really getting down to the business that needed to be done to work out this compromise.
And I'm frankly pleased to see that even the issue of both the sunset and the notice provision, which seemed to be sticking points at the beginning of the session, has been managed to be worked out to everyone's mutual approbation. So with that, thank you very much. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the work that you put into this and also the leadership of Representative Shagerly and pulling us all together.
You bet.
We'll now bring forward Mr. Hauser from the OCDLA, and while we're at it, we'll bring up Floyd Przanski as well. And we'll start with Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Williams. As you note on my sign-up, I did mark this to be a neutral position on this bill, and the reason why I signed up to testify is that I would like to point out that on page 23, 4B, that section does not require a conviction, and we feel that that could be a flagging point for practitioners after this bill is passed into law. So I just wanted to let you know that we have some concerns about that. However, under the basic concept of the bill, otherwise, we feel pretty good about it.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome back, Representative Przanski.
Thank you, Chair Williams and committee members, for allowing me to have an opportunity to testify on support and on behalf of the supporters of the Oregon Property Protection Act. I also helped and assisted in the drafting and also worked with the work group to some level after it was passed by the voters back in November, and have been involved in many of the discussions, and I would agree that it has been an effort that has been put forward by all individuals involved to reach a consensus to make certain that we address many of the concerns that had been raised during the process of the election as to the prior to the passage and after the passage, to make certain that we can continue to see civil forfeiture work efficiently within this state. I know that you were informed about 2 weeks ago when House Bill 2429 came forward that you were told that it was the will of the voters who pertains to the passage and the desire to see some modification to the current civil forfeiture within the state. The voters did speak very clearly that they wanted to make certain a couple of things occurred. Number one, that there was, in fact, a conviction prior to their actual forfeiture being completed. And second, that they're on the proceeds that come from forfeiture, that they're strictly limited to avoid any potential claims or conflicts of interest. The original bill that you saw 2 weeks ago basically put forward what was necessary to implement Measure 3 into law, because it went into the Constitution and modifying the statutes that are currently on the books under Chapter 475A. Unfortunately, it's my understanding at that time, when you heard the bill about 2 weeks ago, that there was testimony that seemed to indicate that the supporters of Measure 3 were wanting to actually end civil forfeiture entirely. I'm here to tell you today that is entirely not true. As a prosecutor for approximately 13 years, I was one of the drafters of this legislation, and it was never my intent, and none of the other individuals involved in the drafting of Measure 3, to do away with civil forfeiture. All we wanted to make certain was that there is additional safeguards, and the voters have agreed that these safeguards are necessary and that they want that into the law. These limitations and procedures that must now be followed are going to be statutorily implemented through this bill, 2429, and it clearly will require that the law enforcement, as well as anyone that's involved in the forfeiture proceeding, follow the guidelines that were established by the voters. We work diligently, as I mentioned, with law enforcement, as well as other members of the communities, to make certain that we answered all of the questions that needed to be answered, and make certain that we had a process that was going to be fluid and continue to work as we wanted and needed it to work to be effective within the state and to provide proceeds for the state as well as local communities and jurisdictions for what they feel is important in their programs. The amendments that you have before you today have just basically come off the press. My understanding is that the Dash 3 has done a consolidation of numerous work group provisions, and that it does in fact include a way that the forfeiture against an individual who flees the jurisdiction can occur, and it will not impinge the ability to take that action. The second part of the Dash 3 is regarding the notification. Mr. Podanky has gone over that quite well. This, again, will ensure that an individual does, in fact, have the information that is necessary to know what is going to happen and how they can, in fact, proceed to make a claim and preserve whatever right they have. If I can break away just a moment from that and try to answer a question that Representative Lowell raised as to whether this is somehow going to cause an additional bail requirement, I would say in my practice as a prosecutor, I do not see this as another bail requirement. Basically, what we have is we have a notification that's very loose at this point and does not really give guidance or guidelines to an individual who potentially could lose their property through forfeiture. What the new notification will require is additional information to be given to the individual so they can, in fact, know what the steps they would need to take if they want to go forward in preserving whatever interest they have. There will be no obligation on their part to do anything, but this is more of for a full informed decision on their part by having the additional information that we as supporters believe are lacking. So many individuals do not know where to turn or how to fill out the forms or who they can need to keep in contact with to know what may happen in the future. Again, this notification will not actually begin the actual service and the process. It is only informational, and there will still be a requirement by the seizing agency to actually serve them with the official commencement of the proceeding, and at that point they will have had the information previously given to them at least 21 days prior to give them the opportunity to maybe get legal counsel, to get any other information they may want before they get the official documentation that would in fact commence that on that process.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Representative White. Okay.
It's so good to see you again, Floyd. You don't think that some law enforcement agency might want to use this as a tool and give notice of intent, oh, we're going to seize your house, by the way, and somebody's out on bail, and that would further tether their feet to the ground and keep them from, say, leaving the jurisdiction? You don't think this would ever be used as a coercive tool to make somebody stay around, hang around, when perhaps the law enforcement agency didn't really intend to seize the property or just flexing their muscles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, the way in this criminal process, if an individual is going to be charged with an offense, depending on what stage it is, they're going to have to go before the court and be arraigned. If they're arraigned, they're going to receive some type of release agreement. More than likely, that release agreement is already going to hinder their ability to leave the jurisdiction. Now, regarding prior to that time, this is not the tool or the mechanism to actually require anyone to stay anywhere. I would submit to yourself, what you're going to have is just more information for the individual to consider. This is an attempt to make certain a person is fully aware and informed what steps they will have to take in the future if they decide and if they want to be in a position of a claimant to preserve whatever interest they have in the property. Now, if they choose to leave and go to some other location, they would need to do under this notice is to stay in contact with the seizing agency so they can, in fact, receive that information. Now, if they decide to leave the jurisdiction, that might cause them to come back at some point. If they feel that that would be necessary to preserve their interest in the property, but I personally do not see that as a new mechanism or a new tool for law enforcement to use to hinder someone's access and freedom from
home.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Representative Prozanski? Okay, good. Thank you both, gentlemen. Thank you, Floyd, for all your work on this issue. Next, I'd like to have Phil Lemon from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and Madeline Wessel from the City of Portland come forward. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Why don't we start with you, Phil?
Mr. Chair, members, Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. I'm here because the Commission staffs the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee. Right now, or I should say prior to Measure 3, the oversight function was funded by a percentage of proceeds from all the civil forfeitures over which it had oversight authority. And prior to Measure 3, those were civil forfeitures based on violations of drug laws. Under Measure 3, it created a constitutionally required oversight body and gave that body oversight authority over all civil forfeitures, whether related to narcotics or other types of prohibited conduct, and whether those were authorized by state statute or established by a local ordinance. Typically, the local ordinance forfeitures deal with drunk driving, prostitution, and other related offenses that were previously not subject to oversight by the committee. The question for you is how you want to fund that oversight activity now. We've seen a substantial reduction in the level of forfeitures. You have a constitutionally required oversight function that you're going to have to pay for in some way. What the Dash 4s do is say that any forfeiture over which the committee has oversight authority must contribute a percentage of the forfeiture proceeds to fund oversight activity. The Dash 3s continue the current system that says only drug-related forfeitures fund the oversight function. And so the work group, since it stayed close to implementing the strict requirements of Measure 3, did not put that in the Dash 3s, and so I wanted to bring that issue for you in the Dash 4s.
Thank you. Madeline?
Good morning. Madeline Wessel, Chair Williams and members of the committee. I apologize for not having written comments on this particular point since we were presented with the Dash 4 proposal only this morning. Just as a quick preliminary, as a member also of this drafting group, I want to express enormous appreciation for the work of your staff. Marilyn O'Dell and Dave Hendricks have done a fantastic job of staffing what has been a really complicated process, and we appreciate it. And I also certainly want to endorse the eventual product of the committee. It's been hard work, and we support the outcome of it. With respect to the Dash 4 amendments, I must come here and express some ambivalence. I would like to have been in a position to evaluate them as part of the final work of the committee, and it does essentially provide for another mandate on local governments to contribute to this particular oversight function. However, I also respect the reality that this function needs to be funded somehow, and that civil forfeitures are broadly brought within the sweep of Measure 3 and brought under the umbrella of the committee. So I am not going to be here today on behalf of the city and express strong opposition to it. We would prefer, I think, to remain neutral on this point at this point and see how the process continues to develop. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either Mr. Lemon or Ms. Wessel on this point? Representative Vicki Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one. Mr. Lemon, the Dash 4 and the Dash 3, the only difference is the addition that you've made, that you are suggesting that we expand it to all forfeitures.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I have not had time to go through and detail the changes. I'm informed by counsel that the only distinction between the Dash 3s and Dash 4s is the scope of the funding mechanism for the Oversight Committee. So the answer is yes.
We're going to have, I'm going to bring Mr. Hendricks up, actually, to briefly chat about the amendments, Representative Walker, but it is my understanding that that's the only difference in the dash fours, is the addition of Mr. Lemon's suggesting that we expand the oversight funding function to include all forfeitures. Okay, thank you both. David, will you come back up? Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I guess you helped sort of head up the proponent side. I guess I want your reaction to the dash four amendments if we were to adopt the dash fours.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, David Sedanke, ACLU of Oregon. The work group did discuss this issue fairly early on, and we made a number of decisions going through the process that we, in general, we were going to leave the existing statute alone unless there was a provision in Measure 3 that required a change. Or we could reach consensus on some new provision. There were objections from local governments to the suggestion that they be required to help fund the Oversight Committee in all situations. And so we left that issue alone in the work group because we could not reach consensus on it. My recollection is that the understanding was that Mr. Lemon would come to you at this point and ask you to make that decision one way or the other. Is that clear?
Yeah.
I think we've been able to resolve all the other issues, but we didn't come back to this one, Mr.
Right. Well, obviously, my concern, I am caught, I guess, on the horns of this dilemma like the rest of you. On the one hand, we've expanded the oversight responsibility in ballot measure 3, and we ask the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to do a lot of things, much of which we don't give them resources to accomplish. At the same time, I guess I don't want to put this thing through with the adoption of the Dash 4 amendment if that means that when it gets over to the Senate, there are going to be people lining up to essentially oppose the good work of this work group. So, I don't want to put Madeline any further on the spot than I already did this morning by asking her to come forward and take a final position on it. But I am,
Mr. Chair, forgive me for interrupting, but there is a lot of uncertainty regarding the funding of the effect of ballot measure 3 and House Bill 2429 on forfeiture receipts. It's very difficult, if not impossible, at this point to know what the revenue stream is going to be in this coming biennium. In many ways, we are, as we might have been back in 1997 when required deduction for the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee was first implemented, no one really knew what that percentage was going to turn into in real dollars. And because different jurisdictions are taking greatly varying positions on the extent to which they'll be doing civil forfeitures in the wake of ballot measure 3, some jurisdictions, as you've heard, are saying they will not do any civil forfeitures under ballot measure 3 or under House Bill 2429. And it's going to take some time for all of that to sort out. So I think regardless of what the committee does, there may be more revenue than the committee needs. There may be quite a bit less than what the committee needs to do its job in this coming biennium, and I think there's going to have to be some understanding that it's very difficult to project what the portion of that funding will be over the next two-year period until things settle down.
Thank you, David. Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a just thought came to me. I have some written testimony here from Michael Schrunk, who says their office in Portland stopped doing civil forfeiture and has no intent to do so in the future. Would that change with implementation of this law? I mean, law enforcement agencies be more likely to go back into the civil forfeiture business if they know what the ground rules are, and so therefore money would start flowing back?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, the cynics among us might say there was a lot of posturing going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly is a great deal of disagreement and widely varying opinions regarding Ballot Measure 3 and House Bill 2429 among folks in the law enforcement community. You have had testimony that has been at both ends of the spectrum before this committee on this bill. Some agencies are saying that they can work with Ballot Measure 3 even though they don't like it. Others are pinning their hopes on the success of the legal challenge in hopes that soon enough they will be able to come back to you if they're successful in that legal challenge and urge you to repeal House Bill 2429 at the earliest opportunity and go back to the way the things used to be. There is also some ongoing discussions that we are involved in, those of us who support Ballot Measure 3, exploring the possibility of a criminal forfeiture mechanism, which would link forfeiture with the actual criminal proceeding, require proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the property was directly connected to the crime for which the person is being convicted. In return for that, law enforcement folks want a portion of the proceeds earmarked for law enforcement purposes. We have not reached agreement on that proposal, but we are involved in ongoing discussions, and Chair is certainly aware that there is a bill scheduled for a hearing on April 10th to deal with that issue. It's very difficult at this point to know exactly what is going to be happening once the session is over and what the practice will be.
Okay.
Thank you,
David.
Chair.
Now we'll have another David come forward. Mr. Hendricks. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel. The Dash 3 amendments do incorporate the changes that the work group had generally agreed to at the last meeting. Hopefully it's all accurate. I put it together very quickly yesterday morning, but I think it's all there. The Dash 4 amendments include those changes, and in addition includes the language requested by Phil Lehman, and that's on page 38, essentially, that would allow or would require local governments to make the deduction for the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee from all forfeitures, not just from those related to drug-related activities.
Section 5A.
It's actually between subsection 4 and subsection 5 are the two that split it in two and say, because 5A actually retains the limitation to drug-related for purposes of deposits in the illegal drug cleanup fund, which is also has a mandatory deduction from forfeiture proceeds at this time.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you give me some examples of what other kinds of forfeitures might be included?
Chair Williams, Representative Lowe, we have about three or four other statutes that currently allow the use of Chapter 475A procedures for doing forfeiture. We enacted one last session, for instance, for forfeiting cars used in drive-by shootings. Many local jurisdictions are authorized under existing Chapter 475(8) by ordinance to, in essence, do forfeitures for violation of an ordinance as long as they use 475(8) procedures. And, for instance, the City of Portland was doing forfeitures for prostitution. So those were some of the other areas where the proceeds from some of those would now have a mandatory percentage that would go to the oversight fund to help fund those activities.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Hendricks, did we not pass a bill last session also Representative Vorvalau had that you had to forfeit your car in a drunk driving situation if you'd had so many drunk driving tickets?
Well, yeah, we remember that bill, don't we?
Yes, we do. I can't remember if that ever passed.
Oh, yeah, trust me, it passed. And it left a big wake of all sorts of problems, so.
Okay, so that's another example, Representative.
Maybe not a good example, but another example. David, talk to me about the conceptual amendment we're going to make with respect to the sunset on July 31, 2005.
Chair Williams, it's my understanding that the work group at the last meeting decided that there would be a sunset on the changes to Chapter 475A, and they had indicated that it would be on July 31st, 2005. It would be my intent in doing that sunset to essentially put the statutes exactly back to the way they are now. And I'm saying that to everybody here in the room. There were a lot of things that I think we identified in going through where we made little things that were probably just good little corrections in the law. But because of the need to have sureness as to what you're adopting here, I think the only safe way for purpose of sunset is to say, look, even though it may have been a good idea to do some of those things, the safest thing at this point is just to say 475A will look exactly the same way on July 31st.
Who are you testifying to, David?
I think the entire room at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
And that would be our goal, is just to have it go backwards. Although I would recommend that if in the event that ever happened, that perhaps before we got to that point, that a work group maybe reconvene and look at what improvements could be made to some of the language in this chapter since there are plenty of areas where it could use some...
And David, to do that, you would need to put essentially a repealer in every section of the bill. Is that right?
Well, Chair Williams, our practice on sunsets now is to essentially, we'll have to double amend the
right
section. So the bill, the amendments are going to be at least twice as long when you receive them. When you see them printed, that's the way we have to do it. We amend it once now, and we re-amend it with a delayed operative date in 2005 to put it back.
I just want to stop and briefly inform the committee. The reason that we don't have those amendments in front of us is because it makes the bill at that point then so cumbersome to understand what's happening because of the double amendment with the sunset that we asked Dave to keep the amendments clean for purposes of our discussion here today. And we're just going to adopt the sunset amendment conceptually, and then that will be in the final printed version of the amendments. But it would have made it very difficult. It would have doubled the size of the amendment, and you would have been struggling as you read it to figure out exactly what was and wasn't staying in as a result of the sunset provisions.
And I'll just say for the record that July 31st sunset date, the form and style manual does indicate the dates for sunsets, and the reason we have that in the form and style manual is because of problems we've had in the past with dates of this type where it's near the end of the session, and in the past we've had big problems where everybody says, well, we'll pass a bill quick during that session to get rid of the sunset or to make other changes. And we've had scenarios where I didn't get to the governor until after the sunset date with the problem with the law suddenly being sunset, revived, we end up with complicated. And I understand, though, that this was also understand that this is a key piece of the agreement between the parties on this particular bill and pretty crucial to the understanding.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to have been to be late arriving this morning. Sounds like I must have missed something momentous. Dave, did you say we're near the end of session? Well, you leave for a couple of hours and you miss everything.
Chair Williams, yeah, we're about as close now as probably we are to the end of session in 2005. nobody knows. But anyway, I do want to put that on the record. Foreman
okay.
Comment normally would require a sunset date in January of the following year to avoid that possibility of having the law lapse and then try to revive it.
And committee, I'll just tell you that the negotiated sunset date tied into the notice provisions was a critical part of the parties coming to agreement on this issue. We as the committee, the Foreman style manual is just that. It is the manual. We have the ability by our committee decision to set aside its directions on this and to direct legislative council to adopt a mid-year sunset provision, and it would be the chair's recommendation that we do that today. David, is there anything else you have for us? Are there any other questions for Mr. Hendricks? Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2429. I'm going to open a work session. Committee, we received information today from legislative fiscal that they have not had an opportunity to complete the fiscal on this bill. The reality is that I'm not sure it's going to matter what the fiscal says. This is the implementation of ballot measure 3. We're under an obligation to do it. So, you know, the fiscal will be whatever it will be. As a result of that, this bill will at some point end up in front of the Ways and Means Committee. It is my recommendation that we pass the bill out up to the full committee and then on across the floor. That will give legislative council an opportunity, or excuse me, legislative fiscal an opportunity to finalize the fiscal on the approved bill when it lands in Senator Minnis's committee, and the Senate then can refer the thing directly down to Ways and Means. So that's my recommendation to the committee at this point. With respect to the fiscal, and so we are in work session, and I will just, Representative Shirley, you were active in this process. You did miss out on the discussion. We have before us two sets of amendments, the dash threes and the dash fours. The dash threes and the dash fours both address the issue of the notice provision and several other issues, including one related to fugitive forfeiture issues. They are all generally agreed to. The difference with the dash fours is it includes that a percentage of the funds from all forfeitures, not just drug forfeitures, would go to the Criminal Justice Commission for oversight. And that's the discussion. Currently, the City of Portland has testified neutral on the dash fours, but they only got an opportunity to see them today. So that's sort of the posture we're at. I believe that it is going to be our responsibility, one way or the other, to fund the Criminal Justice Commission's new oversight responsibilities that were mandated by Ballot Measure 3. As a result of that, the chair's inclination would be to support the dash fours at this time, because I think at some point, if we're going to have them do that oversight, they've got to have a way to fund that process, and I think this is probably as good a way to do it as any. Representative Vicki Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't support the dash fours today because I think it's too early to determine whether they're not going to have the sufficient money necessary to fund this program. I agree that there's probably been some posturing going on, and if they want the dash fours, they can talk about it by the time they get over to the Senate, but I don't think people have had enough time to review that. The work group spent a lot of time on this issue and didn't want to touch that, and I can see why, and I would not want to go there today.
But okay. Any other indications from committee? Representative Ackerman? Nope. Representative Ringo?
I just have a question on where we are on this. I mean, I've got the agenda for the full committee, the work session, scheduled for 9:30 today.
That's right. We're not there yet.
Okay.
And this is still the subcommittee.
And then we're going to immediately move into the full work group.
Into the full committee.
Okay.
And then we're going to open a hearing on this bill, and we're going to move it out today.
Okay.
That's what I figured. Okay. It's been a long day.
Any other comments? Okay. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to move the conceptual amendment, which we're going to adopt conceptually, of the July 31st, 2005 sunset date to be conceptually amended into House Bill 2429. Is there any further discussion on that amendment? Any objection? Hearing none, the bill is amended. The chair would move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2429. Is there any discussion? With that, then, I will have Shannon call the roll. And this is the subcommittee roll, Shannon.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative
Bucker? No.
Aye.
Aye. The Dash 4 amendments are adopted, and that will, I think, close. Now, I guess now we need to move the bill. Yeah. I'm getting ahead of myself. Chair would move House Bill 2429 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative.
Aye.
Well, I didn't get a chance for discussion on this one, but...
Oh, well, I'll pause.
Yeah.
You want to discuss?
Well, I just, you know, I don't support the Dash 4, but I support the work group efforts announced back, and I'm going to go ahead and support this. And I made my protest, and we'll leave it at that.
Okay.
So that's I'm an aye.
That's an aye vote. Okay.
Aye.
Votes aye. House Bill 2429 is amended, moves to the full committee. And we will now close the subcommittee hearing on criminal law and open the committee meeting for the full Judiciary Committee. Yes. Oh, okay, you need to close out. We will take a 45-second pause.